Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Dyson Sphere edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, have we seen the Dyson Sphere, saltwater on Mars, Planet 9, and gravitational waves? Let's begin episode 327.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Joining me yet again in the Radio Freethinker virtual studio is Nicholas. Say hello, Nicholas.
Hello, everybody. How's it going?
And Gulid has joined us yet again.
Hey there, Freethinkers.
And guiding us during our journey of scientific exploration, once again returning, is Matt. Say hi, Matt.
Hi, Matt.
So, Matt, this week is your chance to tell us what is so exciting in the science news world. Start us off with what you think was a great story in the news this year, last year, whenever.
All right. See, the great thing about having your own segment is you get to decide what was the most important thing. So I'm going to start us off with a fan favorite, which would be the proposed Dyson Sphere discovered circling a star a fair distance away. And for those of you who don't know what a Dyson Sphere is, it's that ball that, you know, Dysons roll on, in fact.
You mean the vacuum?
Yes, exactly. So they found one, several thousand light years away. So, a Dyson Sphere is a hypothetical device that would surround a star, or several set of devices that would surround a star, for the purpose of harnessing energy from that star for a advanced civilization. And while surveying for exoplanets, they came across an interesting phenomenon where a star dipped incredibly amount in its luminosity. I can explain how that system works as well. But essentially, one of the proposed theories of why this dip in its luminosity was so substantial is there was potential for this Dyson Sphere, which has made me very excited.
So you had mentioned that there was the big dip in luminosity. And actually, I think one of the big things was not only that there was a big dip, but the big dip was very atypical. I mean, the first dip, I believe, was like 15% of the luminosity of the star. It had a second event, which I think was 22% or 20-some-odd percent of the luminosity of the star. These lasted extremely long periods of time and were not sort of smooth, smooth in, smooth out events. They were more staggered. There's more jitteriness to it.
Exactly.
To give a bit of a contrast, if that star was looking back at us and it saw Jupiter, Jupiter would be about a 1% decrease in luminosity. So, I mean, we're talking a huge amount of difference here. But why were people even looking at the star in the first place?
They're looking at these stars to search for exoplanets, right? So essentially what we do is we watch a star, and by we, I mean the Kepler Space Telescope. And what it does is it surveys stars and watches for dips in brightness. So they look for a transit. As Don was saying, like a planet like Jupiter would go across the star, it would dip by about a percentage in the amount of brightness that Kepler would see. And that is flagged as a candidate of a star. And with this, as Don was saying, it was a up to 20% and lasted anywhere between 5 and 80 days at a time. So the fact that there was so much of a dip in this luminosity, or in this this output in its light, the fact that it was so irregular, was, it's very exciting because we just don't know what it is. Now,
actually, and another cool part of this is part of Project Planet Hunters, which is a citizen-driven event. I mean, it's done by NASA, but the idea is to get citizen scientists involved, which I think is another cool aspect of this whole event.
Yeah, it's amateur astronomers is what they're essentially what they're doing. They're trying to increase the rate of looking for these planets or confirming these planets, because Kepler can look at thousands of stars at a time and flags, you know, hundreds of different stars for planet potential candidates. So what they do is they outsource to these amateur astronomers and they pick these things up. So there's so many amazing things that are going on in the world of astronomy today, including this event right here.
Now, you of course mentioned that, you know, this is evidence perhaps for a Dyson sphere. And I guess that is one possible explanation, but there have been a few other ones that have been thrown out there. Mm-hmm.
So, and to be frank, right now, they're saying that there's evidence that it is not a Dyson sphere as well. So, essentially, to start us off here, there's a Dyson sphere can be either a full, you know, sphere around this planet. It can be several different devices that make up kind of a grid, things like that. So I was kind of mentioning that's why there could have been these regularity in the dips. Now, other proposed theories for what's happening were asteroids running into each other, but they were saying that if there was that many asteroid collisions, that there would be it would heat up and there would be infrared light coming off. So that is kind of looked at as not a true potential, looking at other things like comets or other things in the way. But a lot of these they've already disproved. Now, in terms of disproving for this Dyson sphere, what they've been doing is they have been monitoring the area for radio signals and things like that. So they're looking in a specific frequency to see if anyone is sending out signals or if the device itself is sending out signals. But as of yet, they also have not discovered a signal that would transmitting. So a quote unquote hailing signal, if you will.
From what I understand, too, from the research paper itself makes no mention of Dyson spheres of any kind. This was something that I believe one of the people who has proposed or has written the paper sort of said in an interview. And as with anything that the press kind of finds, it says, wow, that is clickbait. And it becomes the main focus of the story.
Yeah, that's true for all things kind of going on right now. Essentially, as I was mentioning with candidate planets, essentially, you know, as I mentioned, what happens is it gets flagged to, you know, we have to confirm the fact that this is a planet, so they need to do more more research to find out if, in fact, that planet is a planet, or, you know, we can say with confidence that it is. But essentially, is something as soon as something comes up, they say, oh, hey, look, there's a candidate planet who, you know, that looks like it might be Earth-like. Some news outlet or BuzzFeeds or whatever, they're going to flag it and say, hey, click here, we found a new planet.
Yeah, and from what I understand, actually, there's a similar kind of, I don't want to say event, but when some of the researchers were looking at this, and as you say, you know, there's been kind of like a couple of observations of this. The Kepler itself has been sort of crippled because some of its gyroscopes are no longer functioning, so it can no longer take the kind of instrumentation that you'd kind of want to verify or follow up on this sort of research. But it was Eta Corvi, which is another star very similar that is showing some of the similar properties of this, and it's been explained away, or at least the underlying theory at the moment, is a late heavy bombardment. So it seems like something that has disrupted either its version of the Oort cloud or the Kuiper belt, and has set some things in towards the inner solar system, which is where you would expect the sort of heating up of gases, which they haven't seen, but also causes objects within those clouds to sort of smack each other and create what I would call cold dust clouds. And that, from what I understand, is the leading substantial argument for what's going on in this era.
Yeah, so as I was mentioning, as it kind of breezed over, asteroids colliding, which would be right nearer to the star, would probably cause heating up. But one of the other suggested theories was comets colliding, and that's kind of what I meant from, you know, the Kuiper belt or heliosphere and that kind of thing, right? So that is said to be one of the prevailing theories. But one of the things is they don't think it would be able to hide that amount of light from it, and it's not nearly as fun to think about, honestly.
So there's some interesting things we can go off on this, but before we go off on there, Nicholas Goulet, do you have anything to add?
Well, I think for a megastructure such as a Dyson sphere, let's say they are building a Dyson sphere, some alien civilization is working on that, it's probably going to take up different phases. It's probably not going to finish in one go. It takes over time. You slowly build up. So you wouldn't be able to see the dip of luminosity in a very dramatic way, like such as 50% at a time. I think if they are building they were about to build a Dyson sphere, it's probably going to take, 2% or 1% at a time, and then slowly decrease to all the way once they finish the project.
Actually, it's interesting you brought that up, because one of the things I did, because to be fair, most anyone who's done any kind of science fiction knows what a Dyson sphere is, probably to some degree. But actually, there's variations of this. First of all, I should give props up to Freeman Dyson, who in a 1960 paper called Searching for Artificial Stellar Sources of Infrared Radiation, what a sexy title, basically came up with a scientific version of what a Dyson-type object would be. Now, to be fair, he didn't invent this. This has been attributed to science fiction writer Olaf Stapledon, and a novel called Starmaker in 1937. But there are basically stages of this Dyson sphere. So there's the idea of the Dyson swarm, which is, to be fair, is what most scientific-ish sort of articles have been referring this to. So basically, a Dyson swarm is basically you put a bunch of solar collectors along a particular orbit. So let's say for Earth, we shot out every day, we shot perpendicular to us a solar collector every day. So you have like 365 of these solar satellites orbiting the sun at a geostellar orbit. And that would be sort of your level one Dyson swarm. But then as the civilization became more complex, it would create maybe something they call a Dyson bubble. So basically, instead of having just one sort of circle, you have as many as, I guess, 365. So these are all small, independent orbiting solar stations, but they go from collecting sort of 1 degree of solar energy to collecting 365 degrees. But it's, again, there's lots of gaps and that sort of thing. Then you get the Dyson shell, which is where they totally encase the stellar object and collect 100% of its solar mass, which, on another sort of side note, would make it a level 2 Kardashian-scaled civilization. But I'll tease that one for later.
Not to be confused with Kardashian.
Yes, which is no civilization at all. And at which point, the civilization collects 100% of the energy from the stellar mass, and who knows what you could do with that. You're starting to approach then having enough energy to do something like the space warp and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and to put it in perspective, I think we're at a 0.78, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, around that, 0.73 to 0.78-ish.
And what is the scale, since you guys seem to know where we are on it? I don't want to hog the whole explanation.
Shall I? Do you guys know what it is? Because I do.
The Kardashian scale?
Yeah.
Yeah, like the three levels of civilization, yeah. Right? But you can go ahead and explain it. I just read it off from Wikipedia.
I do not know, on the other hand.
So, it was great. I learned this from one of Michio Kaku's books. But obviously, you know, it's shown a lot in other forms. But essentially what the scale is different levels of civilization. So level one would be being able to harness the amount of energy coming from your host planet. So that would be all geothermal, tidal, wind, etc., coming from your planet. That would be so whatever it might be, right? All the ores and etc. We are at a 0.78, and then so once we're able to collect all of the energy in a certain way from our host planet, and we can start collecting from our sun, that would be, we move on to a level two. Now, in order to be past level two, that's able to collect all of the energy from your host star. So the Dyson sphere, once you're able to actually complete the shell, that would be the graduating process, the evolution of going from a level two onto the level three. And what level three is being able to, this is very theoretical, but being actually able to harness all of the energy within a galaxy. So that I don't think anyone would be, or sorry, anyone, quote unquote, any civilization would be close to, but you know, it's a massive universe out there.
And actually, to put maybe just some numbers to that, and again, when you're dealing with the total energy of anything, these numbers are very fuzzy and flexible, but the type one is recorded at 4 times 10 to the power of 12. You get type 2 as 4 times 10 to the power of 26, and type 3 is 4 times 10 to the power of 37, which is a heck load of energy.
What's the unit?
Is it terawatts, I would assume?
No, watts. Well, you'd be looking at, the type 2 would be a yattawatt.
Yattawatt.
Yes. We are probably closer to a petawatt. And remember, that's the amount of energy per second, right? So this is not like, oh, in a year we might use, you know, a terawatt of energy.
Yeah,
it's not scary.
Yep.
Gulid, you confessed that you didn't know what this was. Why?
Because I wanted the explanation. If we all knew what it was, then
there could be no learning, and that would be the end of meaningful life as we know.
Exactly.
Well, that's the end of the podcast. See you later.
So those are actually tremendous amounts of energy. And, you know, I mean, the whole idea about civilization being able to do this kind of thing, that leads to another interesting question that I've kind of covered on the show, but I sort of did it solo. Now that I have my Brainiac panel, what if this really was a Dyson swarm? And you have this civilization this powerful, and maybe by now they've actually built a Dyson sphere, and warp travel is capable. Do we really want to meet these people or not? I mean, our own experience with meeting, quote, inferior cultures has not really been that positive. And one could only wonder what a civilization capable of constructing a Dyson swarm, let alone a Dyson sphere, would regard humans as. Gulid, what do you think about this?
Given those points, I probably would not want us to meet these advanced life forms. They're highly capable, and we have been somewhat hostile to those inferior life forms that we've come across. So I don't think that would be a positive outcome for us.
I was just doing some random research, and I found out this dark forest theory. I'm not sure you guys heard about. So basically what that means is Hypothetically speaking, there's a lot of civilization in the universe, and the universe like a forest at night. So different civilizations are basically like hunters. And we don't know each other's location, and we don't know each other's intention. So whoever exposed first, because change of suspicion, we probably gonna, you know, all attack the person, the civilization who exposed himself first in order to protect ourselves. So if, let's say, there were a civilization or building Dyson Sphere, and some other civilization will be able to detect that and then start some sort of a invasion or attack to that civilization. But for us, I would like to stay back and watch the show, try to stay as silent as possible before we get attacked.
Two rabbits. Matt, are you a rabbit or a wolf, or are you something in between?
Half rabbit, half wolf. Is that a possibility? So,
wolf in sheep's clothing.
Sheep's clothing. That's fair. When great minds like Stephen Hawking are letting us know that we do not want to run into civilizations, you know, that's the biggest worry here. And I mean, he's not wrong. As Gulad mentioned, you know, we were, or might still be not very welcoming to those of that we view as inferior. But also to these beings, are they going to see us as ants? You know, will they see us as beings at all? You know, so we have no problem going into a forest and getting rid of habitat for creatures, and maybe that's what they view us as. But for me, I honestly could care less. I want to try it. I want there to be a first contact, because you never know until you find out. And obviously you can go very awry very quickly. But, you know, arguably our civilization is doomed anyway. So why not branch out and evolve and explore as much as we can before the inevitable doom occurs?
Proving myself to be the ultimate in a balanced sample, I should start off by saying there's a thing called the Fermi paradox, which basically postulates that, you know, if given the number of planets and the length of time, there should be billions of civilizations out there, and we don't see any, so where are they? And one of the solutions to this is that sort of the first civilization to have interstellar transport has basically done what we might do, is go around and wipe out any competition before it has a chance to become a threat to it. That's the negative side. The positive side, to which I think I believe in much stronger, is that humans have evolved as well over time. It seems like the more technologically advanced, the more we have time to develop as a culture, we do get better at these things. So, you know, you go back 1,000, 2,000 years, when you went into an area, your first instinct was to wipe out everyone and claim everything as your own. Then, and don't get me wrong, this is not saying this is a good thing, as you go for the age of colonization, you go in and you subjugate everyone. So you haven't killed them. You've just sort of subjugate them, which, again, is not good for the people being subjugated, but it shows an evolution of our dealings with it. And I think now, and you see this with tribes in the Amazon, where we go out of our way, we make an active effort to try and protect and preserve them. Again, we don't do it very well, but it shows a constant sort of humanization, which I guess in the concept of a galactic civilization is inappropriate, but a drive towards a more humane approach to this. And one would hope that a civilization that had the length of time to develop technologies that would allow them to build the Dyson Sphere would also be able to see life in a much more nuanced, much more compassionate way, so that when we look at these civilizations, we're projecting our own fears and I guess our own violence upon them, which I think is a little unfair for them. So I'm with Matt. Bring it on. Let's see it, guys. I mean, face it. You can walk on the street and get hit by a car. It's only a matter of time. Let's see what the universe has to offer. And on that note, as positive as it is, we're going to pause and take a bit of a break.
Lincoln Alexander was a Black Canadian who achieved much in politics. The child of Jamaican immigrants, he served in the Royal Canadian Air Force during World War II. He graduated from the Osgoode Hall Law School in 1953 and practiced at a number of firms for more than a decade. In 1968, he ran in Canada's federal election in the Hamilton West Electoral District. He won and became Canada's first Black Member of Parliament. He served four consecutive terms before stepping down in 1980. In 1985, he was appointed Lieutenant Governor of Ontario, becoming the first Black Canadian to hold a vice-regal position. Alexander passed away on October 19, 2012. In December 2013, Lincoln Alexander Day was made a law in Ontario and is held on January 21st. His wife, Marnie Beale Alexander, is currently working to make it a national holiday for Canada. This has been a Black History Month PSA brought to you by CITR.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, the galactic overlords of the skeptical universe. And we're back. So, Matt, we've got the aliens coming to Earth any day now. Before they get here, you better tell us, what else is on your list of big news things?
Well, how about a potential of old life? So, I mean, obviously we did not find any life anywhere, but NASA confirmed last year, near the near September, that there's evidence of liquid water flowing on Mars. So this is very saline water, and it's flowing near valleys and off of cliffs and mountains and things like that. But this is flowing water, and obviously we've discovered water many times previously, but not this kind of flowing water, which is a very promising thing to see and a very, very nice thing to see. Which obviously we hear more and more as the possibility of harboring some kind of life still.
So let's start off with what I think would be your type one level of excitement about water on Mars. So before, as I say, we've had lots of evidence that Mars at one point had a fair amount of water on its surface. We're not quite sure how long it was there, so it may have been periods where it was there for thousands of years, or maybe millions of years, or maybe billions of years. And that's very important as far as the development of life goes. But it's exciting to know that there's at least a strong likelihood that there will be fossilized life on Mars from all these sort of topological type events. And then you, of course, have the type two, where it seems like there are places where you could have water either locked up in stone or in ice or whatever. And that's exciting, not so much as far as Martian life goes, but if we were to send a colony or some other type thing, these reservoirs of H2O would make colonizing Mars really, really exciting. And of course, you have the type 3 event, which is like, as you say, flowing water. And from all our experience, and we have a subject matter of only one, which is the Earth itself, but on Earth, anywhere you seem to find water, and we're talking in boiling water, we're talking in very acidic water, we're talking in nuclear cooling pools, there is life. If you have water, there will be life. There seems to be very little, if any, exceptions to that. So if there is water on Mars, running water, even if it's really salty, and if there was at one point life on Mars, which again, we pretty much believe it's really true that there was at one point, then there may actually be microbes in this running water. Woohoo, cool. Gulid, Nicholas, your thoughts about this?
Yeah, it would be cool to have life on Mars.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's cool. Back to you.
I mean,
what would it taste like with Szechuan?
Before 1965, a lot of people actually thought there were life on Mars. You know, they're building like channels, canals to diverge the water. And then until 1965, Mariner 4 passed by Mars and then shot a few pictures. And then people realized, oh, there's actually no life on Mars. But it'll be cool to see some sort of, you know, even microorganisms on the planet that's not on Earth.
So, I mean, it is interesting to find water on Mars. It does look like a small quantity of what was, and it would be interesting to see what develops on Mars, although I don't think it'll be anything anytime soon.
I mean, on another thought, if there were water on Mars, it would be much easier to contaminate Mars. You know, if we drop some sort of satellite or rover to the part where there's actually flowing water, and the microorganism that is on part on the rover or on the rover will be, you know, stay on Mars and then maybe even survive there.
You jumped ahead of me. I was going to bring that up later, but that's a good point.
And actually, so another thing here, NASA actually was stating that they can't, according to their guidelines, they can't actually go near this water. You know, so everyone's talking about, oh, why don't you send a rover near the water? And that's because they don't want to contaminate this. You know, there's no way for us to guarantee that the clean rooms that we have put in place to make sure that we don't contaminate any rover or anything sent to another planet is actually fully devoid of life from here, because you know, extremophiles can survive, as the name suggests, they can survive in extreme environments such as you know, the spatial void.
And to amplify that or exemplify that, I do believe, and I have this is going from my memory, that they found mold or something akin to mold growing in one of the lenses on the cameras that went to the moon, right? So it somehow managed to bypass all that. And I think that's one of the great ironies, is that as we find more and more evidence for life on Mars, it makes the accessibility of Mars less and less likely. I mean, if they actually somehow, and we're going to assume by accident, because as you mentioned, there are protocols to try and protect what we think may possibly harbor life. But let's say opportunity or what have you sees a little bug run across the lens. Heaven forbid, let's go there. Essentially, that would be the end of all Martian missions. I mean, we could still orbit, but I'm unsure under what circumstances we would ethically be allowed to actually land anything else on Mars if we knew that there was Martian-type life there. And that raises yet another question, is because we have already landed more than a number of probes onto it, there is also the possibility that even if we did find life on Mars, there is a slight chance that we were the ones that brought it there in the first place. Gulit, I have a very interesting question for you, and I can edit this out if you feel uncomfortable with it, but what's the point of having diversity if you don't use it? As a person of faith, what would this do for your life model? And if not your life model, do you think people who have beliefs like yours would be challenged if life was discovered to be on a different planet that had nothing really in connection, at least on a biological standpoint, from life on Earth?
Well, I don't think that, you know, these are like, you know, different types of belief systems should have any influence on whether or not we investigate life outside of Earth. You know, I think people do have their rights to their own beliefs, but if, you know, an organization such as NASA wants to, you know, investigate life outside of Earth, that should totally be, you know, up to them.
I guess I mean it more on a personal level. And again, I'm not wanting to attribute these thoughts to you,
right,
but there are a class of people who believe that the Earth is a unique creation, and that, you know, that it's divine. Therefore, to find that life may exist outside of God's one and only, or Allah's one and only, or Yahweh, whoever, that would be a challenge to one's faith.
That is true to some degree. I think it's about finding as much definitive evidence as possible, because there are a lot of hypotheticals when we're talking about extraterrestrial life. So if there is enough evidence found, then I think that people would have to be forced to accept that.
You mean like creationists believe that the Earth is 4-point-some billion years old? And...
That's a joke. Well, that's a discussion for another time, I think.
Yeah. No, that's fair. And like I say, why have diversity if you're not going to pull up? Yes, right?
Just to add to that, I went on a cycling trip with a friend of mine, and you know, we did the typical lie under the stars and have a deep conversation. And actually, it was because we saw the International Space Station go overhead, so we ended up talking about it. But he's very Christian. And we were talking about, you know, life on other planets. And he said, yeah, no, I think there's life on other planets, but I don't think there's sentient life on other planets. So here we go with the, you know, species exist, but humans are special kind of concept. So he kind of got out of it that way. And I said, what if we meet a civilization, you know, what would that say to you? He's like, well, it would probably be created in God's image in one way or another. And says, so how does that work?
Right? There's a term for that. It's called moving the goalpost.
Yeah, exactly. That is exactly correct. You know, here's the first down, move it 10 yards.
So from that type of thing, I mean, I'm pressing Kool-Aid, and Matt has this thing about faith and that sort of thing and how it would be affected. But I mean, quite frankly, myself, who would be the farthest thing from any form of faith, to find that life really does exist somewhere else in the universe would suddenly make Matt's Dyson story seem far much more plausible than it was before. And that would open up a whole, I don't know what it was. It would be, I think, to humanity, bigger than the iconic blue dot picture of, you know, taking a picture from space of the entire planet. The idea that the universe could be so much more than we thought it was. It's and you can probably hear it in my voice. It's this sense of wonder. One of the things that atheists often get tarred with is that they have no spirituality. They have no sense of greatness or greater than themselves. But to me, this would be just so speechless. So before we leave this topic, does anyone else have anything interesting to add to this? Again, mounting evidence, life on Mars, it becomes more and more of a great thing. Do you guys have any parting thoughts on this? Nicholas?
Oh, some people might even argue that the life on Earth has actually come from some other sort of civilization or life from other planets. So it'll be tricky. I mean, it's definitely interesting to see how things turn out.
Yeah, actually, on that note, there is a thought that Mars may have had life before Earth did, partly because there's some thoughts that we had the major event that sort of created the moon, which would have basically sterilized the planet. And there is a belief that at least it's possible for some microorganisms to actually travel the distance from Earth to Mars and from Mars to Earth, and that it's possible that life on Earth was actually seeded from Mars billions of years ago. And then, of course, you have the whole idea of panspermia, which means, well, if it can last between Mars and Earth, then maybe life itself came from some other distant star out there, which would be cool, although it would have the one negative side effect that if life on Earth did, and we somehow knew this, came from Alpha Centauri, at least in the foreseeable future, there would be no way for us to find out what is the origin of life because we literally couldn't go there. Gula, do you have any parting thoughts on this topic?
I think it would be interesting if Mars or us, our technology in general, would develop to a point where we could potentially live on Mars. Because I know there was a lot of talk of Mars one day being a host planet for humans.
Cool. And Matt?
I think that Mars should be its own show. I think that's one of the things that we should look for in the future. I am incredibly excited for the next little while. We're talking NASA is going, they have set up a plan to go to Mars. You know, they're talking about one of the things being bringing an asteroid into lunar orbit in order to have a spot to refuel, essentially. All this amazing stuff, because more and more evidence is coming out with with what's happening on Mars with Curiosity. I think this is so fantastic, and it makes me super excited to be a part of the life that we live right now. Now, one thing to add to what you said, Don, tardigrade is one of the organisms that can survive in the vacuum of space, by the way. It also has a very strange DNA signature. That's just one of the organisms that actually could have potentially made the trip across, which is very cool.
Tardigrades, or as most people like to call them, water bears.
Water bears.
If you ever looked at them, they don't really look anything like water bears, but...
I mean, what's in them? They kind of do.
I can see it.
I mean, they kind of looked like shaved, pudgy water bears, almost like a pug with a hose in the front. It's great. Those things are fantastic.
So, on that fantastic note, we're going to pause for another break, and we'll be right back after this.
In celebration of Black History Month, the African Descent Society will be holding a forum on February 20th from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. at East Hastings Ray Cam Community Center. The forum will feature panel discussions and presentations by professors, MLAs, UN workers, and other experts who will be discussing a variety of topics, including racial discrimination, immigration and refugees, and a special honoring of the historical Black community of Hogan's Alley. There will also be music, drum circles, food, crafts, poetry, storytelling, and a heritage walk tour. So come and join this forum on February 20th.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, a possible emissary of life from Mars. And we're back. So, Matt, what is your final, oh my God, this is so interesting, everybody needs to know about it, science story?
I mean, I don't know if it's as interesting. We kind of started on the super high note, but Planet X, Planet 9, whatever you want to call it, we are... in the midst right now of adding a replacement planet for Pluto. So essentially what's going on now is Caltech researchers have found evidence of a additional fairly large planet, about Neptune size, maybe a little bit smaller, orbiting very far out there in the solar system, you know, outwards of the Kuiper Belt, like further out of that kind of concept, with an elliptical orbit of 20,000 years. So it's massive. That's really essentially what you want to go with here. And so essentially what I mean by evidence is there are several objects in the Kuiper Belt or surrounding it that have these strange orbits, such as comets and all these and other objects, which were most likely perturbed by this planet. So yeah, and they have some strong evidence supporting the fact that we might have a replacement for Pluto. I mean, the other thing I'll just add here, one of the interesting things about this is that one of the researchers who has found, or the lead researcher who has found the information or the data that supports this theory, is one of the lead researchers who killed Pluto. And in fact, so I listened to a podcast or a radio show with him on it recently, and he essentially said that Pluto was just a, you know, the death of Pluto was a side effect. It was a collateral damage of him actually searching for this planet, because essentially they needed to define, you know, what a planet would be, you know, trying to find where it would go, and essentially in doing so, he murdered one of our now beloved heart-shaped dwarf planets.
In order to pivot from that point, one of the things that this particular scientist does is he tries to find, as you say, planet-ish type objects in the Kuiper Belt, and he discovered more and more of them, which of course you came to a point where either we're going to have 9,000 planets or we're going to have 8 planets and Pluto gets demoted. And one of the things that came out of this was that he noticed that some of these dwarf planets, so Pluto-ish type planets, had very similar kind of weird orbits, and that they sort of all kind of shifted to the left and up a bit. And that was kind of weird. And they did a lot of like, hey, you've discovered this, but what could explain it? Kind of like we did with the megastructures. And this is where science is fantastic. So they went and they said, well, maybe this is just a coincidence of stellar birth, right? That these happened to grow up at the same time and they just all sort of pointing this way. But they did some analysis and it seems like anything of that order would dissipate over time so that these couldn't have some sort of common origin story. And then they said, well, okay, is there anything else that would sort of substantiate this? Because, okay, sure, you've got this collection of dwarf types planets and they're all sort of pointing in the same direction. And it looks like something is sort of hurting them or keeping them there. But who knows what it could be? Then they said, well, let's run with the assumption that there is a planet there. If there was a planet there, would it explain anything else weird? Then they had a second set of dwarf planets that were, how should we put it, doing the almost opposite of the original. So the original were sort of going up to the left. Then they had these other ones that were going down into the right, sort of the mirrored reflection of it, which is what you would expect if there was actually a planet doing this particular orbit. And then they said, okay, well, if these two things are happening, we would expect another axis, which would actually be perpendicular to the other two. So both of the first two sets of dwarf planets are more or less on the same plane as all the other planets are. But this third set that they discovered actually is perpendicular. It adds credence to the idea that this must be caused by something that is approximately 10 times the mass of Earth that has this particular orbit. As Matt had mentioned, it's a very eclectic orbit, anywhere from 10 to 20,000 years in duration, which is phenomenally long. But each one of these in and of itself is like, it could be. But when you get evidence upon evidence upon evidence supporting the hypothesis, most scientists now says, yes, there's definitely a planet there. It's only going to be a matter of time for us to find it. But of course, finding planets at this distance is quite hard because, well, you may not know this, but way out there is really, 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 really cold. So there's probably going to be next to no thermal radiation. Two, it's really, really dark. At that distance, the sun itself would just be like another star on the horizon. So there's not going to be a lot of reflectiveness from it. And three, there's a lot of area to try and say, hey, where is it in this? But one of the things that is really fascinating is this is not the first time this has happened. Are you aware of that, guys?
I am not.
The basic idea is that someone says, hey, we have this weird observation. It should be caused by something like, oh, let's say a planet. And they go looking for it, and they discover a planet. Boom, Neptune. Neptune was discovered by the same way in the, I think, 1700s or 18th century or somewhere around there. So they noticed that the orbit of Uranus wasn't quite what they expected. According to Newtonian physics, which, of course, was a new thing at the time, and they were eager to apply it to everything, that it had some perturbations that seemed to be, well, it's like something was nudging it. So someone did all the math and they said, you know, there's probably a planet right about there. And lo and behold, they turned the telescopes to it and they discovered Neptune. So this would not be actually an unprecedented event where the math came before the actual physical observation, which is a win for science in my books. And why I think, Matt, unlike your first one, which was really nice, this is science at its best and speculation at its least.
There were a planet there. I'm wondering what they can name it. You know, of course, you can't call it Planet Nine for a long time.
Planet Beyonce?
Yeah.
Yes.
Planet Lannister?
Or come on, Planet something... Miss Philippines. You know, the mistaken Pluto, and then they realize, oh, Pluto, you're no longer a planet. Now we have another planet.
Yeah. Well, so one of the interesting things that I'll kind of add to that, Uranus used to or could have been called King George, in fact, because it was actually discovered by kind of multiple people at the same time. And in England, they named it King George, which is pretty fantastic.
And actually, the authors of the paper that basically said, hey, we found this. They have actually used the name Jehoshaphat and George to describe the ninth planet. Although, again, they're typically more, how should we say, methodological ways to name planets. So who knows? in the past, you had Taiki used as a name, which I think would be cool, especially if you know anything about Tycho Brahe,
yes,
who was fundamental in us discovering the orbits of the planets in general.
Yeah, that would be actually a very good one. One thing that I would love to see is if they called it Nibiru, which was the theoretical planet that was going to destroy Earth that no one could find.
That'd be bad.
I'm just saying that would be a nice jab in the right direction for science versus science fiction.
What are your thoughts from Planet Nine from stellar space?
It's definitely interesting to see the planet that will potentially replace Pluto in our solar system. It's multiple times larger than Earth. Doesn't look like a likely host for us to get to see. But yeah, it will be interesting to see how it develops.
I think one of the interesting things is there is an assumption, because of where it is, that it's probably going to be some form of gas giant. And gas giant, technical terms, just means mostly made of gas with maybe a small rocky core. But one of the hypotheses is that this, assuming this planet does exist, and let's say it does, that either A, it actually was born in the sort of same area where Neptune is, maybe a little further out from Neptune. So it was more like a normal, regular planet. But because of the early interactions of Jupiter and Saturn and all the rest of them, that it got kind of flung out. And again, there's going to be some other extra gravitational interactions that allowed it to sort of return to sort of a circular orbit instead of flying way off to who knows where. So that's one thing that's kind of interesting, is that who knows what kind of a planet this is. And even more exciting, going back to our panspermia idea of life, is it is possible this is actually a captured planet.
We know that stellar and planetary birth is a very hectic event, and that that planets can be flung out into interstellar space, intergalactic space even, and these are known as rogue planets, as Don mentioned. And the idea that this was snagged from another star, from any kind of other interaction, whether it was during its planetary birth or whether another star flung past it, it would just be a really interesting thing to be able to actually study this thing.
Yeah, actually, again, from what I've done in my, well, not readings, I guess it's, because this is a lot of speculation for podcasts, there's actually probably more rogue planets out there than there are necessarily stellar planets, which would be really interesting. And before you go, but Don, that sounds crazy, you might get one or two flying free. But the assumption is that most stellar masses will have, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 planets in general. But when you factor in that most stars also tend to form binary combinations, which means most of those planets would get thrown off into space, that it's much more likely for us to find a rogue planet than it would be for it to be one from our own inner solar system, which is kind of cool. On that note, and getting ready to wrap up the show, Matt, this is your show. How would you like to end it?
One thing that I'd like to say is an honorable mention, because a lot of these lists end up getting honorable mentions, is that very recently I think it's Burnaby Company, was given a patent for a space elevator-ish type tower. And I just really wanted to make sure that that was out there. Obviously, my science show has a theme, because I love the idea of space. I love the idea of the unknown. I love the idea of being able to travel beyond what we have here, you know. And this, that patent is just another step into not only making it easier for us to get into orbit, to refuel International Space Station, but also for tourism in space. And one thing that all astronauts have mentioned is that once they see the Earth from that perspective of being outside of it, there's this sense of awe, the sense of belonging, the sense of need to take care of that planet, which is also something I find incredibly important in the years to come. So that honorable mention there. But I think to finally wrap this whole thing up, we have to spread science knowledge. And I think that people sometimes are a little bit shy to bring up anything in conversation. Be like, hey, did you guys hear about that cool little blah, blah, blah? You know, they're talking about this and that. And I think it's very important for us to make sure that we're spreading knowledge. You know, we're so focused these days on the on such brief and almost like not like it's like conversations that are shallow conversations.
I think just to jump in here, I think one of the growing trends of our current civilization, and I mean, to be fair, it's shiny bits, is we've gone away from the idea of big science and knowing how the universe works to shiny toys that entertain us, that people care more about their iPhone than they care about the fact that it may be a freaking new planet out there, right?
Yeah.
And we've lost to a certain degree, or maybe lost is too strong a word, that sense of awe and wonder. And one of the best ways to inspire that sense of wonder in people is, honestly, once you sort of show them, once you explain to them, people go, holy crap, I didn't know. And one of the main raison d'etres of Radio Free Thinker is to try and inspire that wonder by informing people of the great majesty, magnificence, wondrousness that is the universe. And what greater thing can one gift another but knowledge?
I couldn't have put it better myself, Don.
That was very well put.
I totally agree.
So on that note, we're going to close out today's show with a bit of web wisdom from the BBC about the newly discovered gravitational waves, confirming Einstein's theory yet again and providing a whole new way of seeing the universe. Let's listen in.
Einstein made this prediction, as you say, 100 years ago, but for decades, actually, it remained a kind of mathematical curiosity. People weren't sure that this prediction of gravitational waves had any real physical meaning, that it was an effect we could detect. And it took until the 1960s before people thought that this was maybe something that was real, that we could actually try and detect, try and sense, and they've taken the following decades in between to get to the point that we are now.
And one scientist put it, the sound of space has changed. I mean, through that sound now, do we get the history of the Big Bang? Do you buy that?
Not yet, but that's a goal for us in future. What we've started to be able to do is to listen to the gravitational history of our universe. We've started to hear sounds from our local universe, from black holes, as we heard today, spiraling into collide. And so far, we can listen to those within a certain volume of our local universe. What we'd like to do is make our detectors even more sensitive to sense further out into the universe. The further out we go, the further back in time we can sense. And eventually, if we can make our detectors sensitive enough, we'd like to reach back to gravitational signals, potentially coming from the Big Bang.
God, it's extraordinary that. Does this tie in with Einstein's theory of relativity? Does it make sense of that? Does it prove it?
Today's result is a fantastic confirmation of Einstein's theory of general relativity. Everything we detected today fits with general relativity, and that is in some ways fabulous. It's a fabulous confirmation of Einstein's prediction. But we know that general relativity, being a fabulous theory, it still doesn't tell us everything, the full story of all the forces that govern our universe. So it's, in some ways, it's fabulous. It's a fabulous confirmation of general relativity, but still there are boundaries to push.
So does it disturb things that scientists had thought were set in stone? I mean, has it created more problems for you when you step back?
I don't think it's created more problems for us. It's given us a new tool, a tool that we really didn't have before, to study as we heard the dark side of our universe, because pretty much everything we know so far we've got by going out and turning our telescopes up, sensing the light that we can see.
So it's all been done with light and all been done visually?
Light and all its different spectrums, so X-rays, gamma rays, they're all part of the spectrum of light.
What does this do to gravity and to our understanding of gravity now, which has always been the most sort of mysterious force, if I can call it that?
It gives us a new tool to try and understand where our limits of Einstein's theory stop. Because for the very first time, we've got objects that have the strongest gravity that we can think of. Black holes, of course, are called black because not even light can escape them. And two black holes merging, colliding, as we saw today, is gravity in its strongest form. And we've just started to be able to see what's happening in those limits of the strongest gravity we can think of. We got our first signal today, just our first hint that we heard about. But to study those systems, it will push our understanding of general relativity to the limits and test really what we know.
Professor Owen, great to have you in. Thank you very much indeed.
I hope you enjoyed the show.
Let's call an end to the show. Nicholas, say goodbye.
Goodbye, guys. Remember, don't forget to think.
Gulit, say goodbye.
Bye, folks. And remember, different skins, but all the same within.
Step number five. Spend time with the person you want to be. Every night.